following program is a peer-to-peer advice show and does not diagnose mental health conditions. If you're seeking social services, please call or text 211 or go to 211.ca. Hello, listeners around the world on radio streaming and podcast services. This is It's Not Therapy. I'm Leanna Kersner, and I am not a therapist, but I am your source for navigating the madness of mental health using my top 10 sayings for checking in with your best self. This week, we're talking about men and intimate relationships. I've done stuff on general masculinity before, but I wanted to go a bit deeper on this specific facet because it's coming up in a lot of the work I do with clients. And I've got an expert on the subject lined up to talk to me, Avram Weiss, PhD and author of Hidden in Plain Sight, How Men's Fears of Women Shape Their Intimate Relationships. We'll talk to me later about, well, how men's fears of women shape their intimate relationships. Ironically, I had an experience over the weekend that spoke to this. Avram had already been booked long before this, so the timing just lined up, but here goes. This was my weekend. As you know, I'm a big nerd. And a trio of nerd things blew up on the internet over Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. One was the Fallout TV show, which is awesome. Fallout TV show on Amazon Prime. The second was the story trailer for a game called Star Wars Outlaws that drew complaints from some people who thought the female character looked too mannish. Personally, I thought she in the game looked pretty good. And then there was the announcement by the company that makes Warhammer 40K. You may have seen this announced in association with Henry Cavill, you know, the guy who's the Witcher and Superman. Yeah, he's doing a Warhammer 40K series also with Amazon. But the company that makes the IP put out a tweet that the elite guard surrounding the Emperor, called the Adeptus Custodes, has always included women, even though some previous material referred specifically to them as sons. I just assumed a few ladies pulled a Mulan, but apparently this whole thing was grounds for a social media riot. While I was talking to one of the very upset guys, I asked him, why does the presence of women make you feel like this thing is not for men? Does something having men in it mean it's not for me? I didn't get a straight answer, but the answer I did get strongly hinted at, yes, it means it's not for me, which isn't at all how I think, but it was quite telling. We know many boys and girls go through a developmental phase where they think the opposite sex is icky. Some people, though, don't grow out of that developmental phase. The words girls' night fill me with dread because of the high likelihood of the women present complaining about their partners. It's the social construct that has launched too many brands of awful low-calorie wine. Diet wine is the point where I want off this planet. And this is also the point where a lot of people would insist that the male hatred of women is worse and more accepted by society, certainly more commodified, but I can't prove that claim, so I'm not going to make it. What I can say with certainty is that a lot of the intellectual properties that are being introduced to the masses right now made their early money off of nerds like me, but in this case, nerdy guys who, you know, are seen as lacking social skills. And this media sent them a lot of message that this is fine, and someday some model pretty woman will come along and like them for them without them having to do any work on themselves. And that was a problem. And it wasn't fair to anyone. And it wasn't these guys' fault. Based on conversations I've had with them, they don't really believe the part about the model falling for them. And they see this as further proof of their failures as a man. Nerd media was a place for what they now call low-status males, awful term, to hide safely from the world, especially the very scary women in the world. The thing is that a lot of these low-status men make good money and therefore aren't actually low-status by any standard, but how many abs can you count? I've worked with men like this both in gaming, as a journalist and a developer, and as a peer counselor. They're the bulk of my client base, and so many of them are really good people. And a great many of them are terrified of women, blame themselves for every social misunderstanding, and have a history of past, sometimes even current, partners who've treated them badly. Note I'm saying they're terrified of women, not that they hate women. Very different thing. For many years, the comic books, video games, and sci-fi shows and movies got blamed for this phenomenon, but I consumed a ton of that stuff, as did a lot of people who didn't catch the brainworms. This content is very much a you-get-out-what-you-put-in phenomenon. Yes, there's a lot of messaging where superheroes are terrible romantic partners because they keep a lot of secrets, constantly cancel or just don't show up to plans, and even put their girlfriends at physical risk because of their secret identities. And they justify the lying as necessary to keep their loved ones safe. But these stories don't encourage the fan bases to label the women in these partnerships, like Lois Lane, Mary Jane, Silver St. Cloud, people like that, as gold diggers, you know, or other terrible things because they object to the apparent flakiness of the men whose name is on the comic book. That's not the intended message of these properties. That's a fear and hatred of women that the consumer has preloaded. So we've spent decades misidentifying this problem, and the problem has grown. And there's been a backlash to the problem with women that has caused an aggression towards these men who make the fear worse. And now we're finally getting to the point where we're getting some better science regarding where these attitudes, the cycle of attitudes, may come from. That's what Avram Weiss, PhD, and author of Hidden in Plain Sight, How Men's Fears of Women Shape Their Intimate Relationships, will talk to me about after the break. So you're not going to want to miss that. Well, maybe you are because, you know, you don't want to be informed. But questions, comments, concerns, Liana at NotTherapyShow is my email. That's L-I-A-N as in Nancy A at NotTherapyShow.com. If spelling my name's too hard, NotTherapyShow.com is the website. Fill out the contact form. Join our mailing list while we're there. Or if you like social media, or if you're on social media, at NotTherapyShow on X, formerly known as Twitter, Instagram, and Threads. We'll be back with Avram Weiss talking men and intimacy on It's Not Therapy after this. The following program is a peer-to-peer advice show and does not diagnose mental health conditions. If you're seeking social services, please call or text 211 or go to 211.ca. We're back on It's Not Therapy. I'm still Liana Kirzner. I'm still not a therapist. And as promised, we are in the interview. I'm here with Avram Weiss, PhD and author of Hidden in Plain Sight, How Men's Fears of Women Shape Their Intimate Relationships. Avram, thanks you for being on It's Not Therapy. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. Okay. So your writing, it's about intimacy. Your Psychology Today blog is called From Fear to Intimacy. But then you get into specific fears of women that men have. Do you know how common this state is in men?
Nearly universal, as far as I can tell, among straight men. It's different for gay men.
Okay.
But I think if you had a mother and you're attracted to women, it's very likely that you're afraid of them.
It's funny because we have this phrase, you know, women marry their fathers, and yet it's not as well known with women. How does a man know if he's afraid of women this way?
Well, you know, we could walk through some of the examples, and I think most of the guys listening now, we wouldn't get past the first one or two before most guys would go. So, for example, one of the very common everyday examples is a guy's at work and a bunch of his buddies come up and say, hey, we're going to go to the bar after work and watch a game. You want to join us? For many men, the first thought, sadly, is not whether or not they would like to go watch the game with their friends, but what?
I'm going to get in trouble at home.
Right. Okay. And what's really sad about that is that the woman at home who he's worried about is probably delighted that he would go. It probably bugs him all the time about not having friends and not. So it's a completely imagined, it's not like there's some harpy at home, you know, henpecking him. But yet for many men, before they even think about whether or not they'd enjoy it, they're worried that they're going to get. And then the language you use is perfect. I'm going to get in trouble. Mm-hmm. You're going to get in trouble with your wife. You're going to get in trouble with your mother.
Yeah, that the wording is unusual, is notable, right? It's not, she's going to be upset, and it's not right. Conditional of, I promise to be home today. There's a particular thing I have to do. It is that immediate, like, regress to 6 years old and have this. Men have this switch, I've noticed in my peer counseling work, that it's like all of a sudden they regress to the idea they're in a childlike state. Women have absolute power over them. And it's really not rational.
Well, be careful to talk about this as a two-person equation, right?
Right.
Because there's two people involved.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's the thing that's important to recognize about this is that it is a pattern that is equally not liked by men and women. And so again, that's the sort of tragic part of it, is so men and women devolve into this more parent-child kind mm-hmm. of relationship, which I've written a lot about. And if you ask men, do you like the way this is going? They say no. And if you ask women, do you like the way this is going? They say no. And so it's terribly tragic that this is the way it goes in so many couples, but it's not, you know, it's a mistake to think that this is serving one or the other of them better. It's not serving either one of us.
Yeah. And I think that's the reason a lot of relationships that don't need to break down, right? People make assumptions. People are trying to avoid getting in trouble.
Sure. Well, the men will say, well, I feel like a little kid in my relationship. It's your fault. So I'm going to divorce you and that'll solve the problem. And I don't think that does solve the problem.
No, because you just replicate the same things unless you face
right.
it.
Right. Yeah. How is it that you got yourself into a situation where you started behaving like a little kid in a relationship? What need in you led to your entering into that kind of situation with somebody who's not interested in being your mother? Because one of the problems with adults, marriage ending up in a parent-child kind of dynamic, is that they tend to be very low sex relationships because most of us are not interested in sex with our mothers.
Yeah. Yeah, that goes without saying. But
well, for most of us.
Yeah. What happens? What's the science behind it of people not being able to get out of that? I guess the term is primary attachment.
The science behind it has to do with sort of profound misunderstandings between men and women. I do these workshops where I address that issue. Usually the workshop is titled something like What Men and Women Don't Understand About Each Other and Why It Really Matters. And sometimes I'll start the workshop by saying to people, how many of you, I'm going to put you on the spot, how many of you had at least some kind of minor disagreement on the way here this evening? Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like usually like about, you know, a quarter to a third of the people in the room, I'm like, why is that? It's not really that complicated to get in the car and get to an event in the evening. And so people will usually be kind enough to offer, and it's the silliest stuff. But when you drill down, you hear that it's, you know, it's just a level of such profound misunderstanding combined with the assumption that you must be thinking about this the way I'm thinking about it.
Yeah.
Which is, and we're not.
No. No, the backgrounds, the social training is very, very different. You deal
absolutely.
With one of your excerpts deals with this idea of masculinity and the avoidance of femininity. And I had this epiphany reading that I'm like, okay, well, what's the female equivalent of emasculate, you know, linguistically? And it's like, effeminate.
That's beautiful. Right. There
yeah.
is nothing. You
there
can't,
is nothing.
You can't be effeminated, whatever that would be.
Well, effeminate so, applies to men as well.
Right.
Right. Right.
But that's a beautiful example. But so women don't live with that fear that men do. Men are really socialized to always worry that they will be seen as not masculine. There's some really interesting data from social psychologists and political scientists about how appearing more masculine is key to winning most elections.
Yep.
And that any example of anything that looks more feminine in this culture, meaning weakness, uncertainty, tenderness, is like a death blow in an election.
Yeah, up here in Canada, we have ongoing rumors among the right that Justin Trudeau is gay with President Zelensky of Ukraine. There's nothing to it. But of course, Prime Minister Trudeau's going through a divorce right now. They just go for that. It has nothing to do with his policy, nothing to do with his ability to govern. It's his masculinity.
Right.
And I think the, you know, you hear with women, the training there is, oh, he's going to cheat if you don't keep him happy. If you get old, you're past your... It's all just feeding into that masculinity construct as well, right? It's all very relative.
Yeah, and what we often overlook in that is how damaging that is to men, not just women.
Right.
So there's a researcher who wrote the foreword to my book, who's Jim O'Neill is his name, he and his colleagues have done over 200 studies on what they call gender role conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Gender role conflict is the distance between who you think of yourself as a man and what society expects you to be as a man. So the more gender role conflict you have is correlated with things like anxiety, depression, mm-hmm. suicidality, health harm, and even early mortality. So it's even actually a life and death. That's part of why men live 7 years shorter than women. So this stuff is not just, you know, frivolous kinds of concerns. These men are not doing well by a lot of measures.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a lot of the reason why.
And it becomes this thing, am I correct? There's a lot of writing about how men only feel permission to be vulnerable in their primary relationship with a woman. Is that correct?
I think that's the best case scenario. It's
right.
A really good point you're making. And unfortunately for men, I mean, that's when everything goes right, men feel comfortable being vulnerable in a primary relationship. But unfortunately, it's often the case that men don't feel comfortable being vulnerable even there. And they're doing the same kind of guarded image management and self-management in their primary relationships. And one of the ways that I address that with men, I think that my field has been pretty awful how we speak to men. And it's often critical and condescending and blaming and pathologizing. And I try to talk to men in ways that I think will incentivize them.
Mm-hmm.
So when I talk to men about what you and I are talking about now, I don't criticize them for being not vulnerable. I point out to them that they're getting the short end of the stick
mm-hmm.
in everything in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
That while they may have power and status and prestige, that they, you know, one of the questions I like to ask guys is what color eyes are your children? What color eyes do your children have?
Mm-hmm.
Or what's your kid's favorite subject in school? Or what's your kid's math teacher's name? Or what is your wife? What, tell me a guilty pleasure of you. I ask them questions about sort of more, and they don't know.
Yeah.
And that's not to criticize them with, but basically saying, so you can tell me every detail of the merger at work you're working on, but you don't know what color eyes your kids have. That to me is the short end of the stick.
Agreed.
To me, you're getting a raw deal. You're getting the worst part of life in spades mm-hmm. and missing out on all the best. And why are you in my office? I think because in some ways, you know that.
How often is the immediate response, but I need to?
Well, I think there's a strong sense of I need to, but I think that's true not just for men. I think that's true for everyone is so, you know, it tends to be locked into their lives the way they are. And it's really one of the things when I work with new people, I sometimes tell them I want to give you a consumer warning, which is that if you continue talking with me in the way you're talking with me, your life is likely to get very different than it looks right now.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't want your life to look very different, you should probably not be talking to me.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we do speak in an entire culture of needs, have tos, should, this idea of duty, collective duty over the individual experience. We put a lot of focus on conforming in many ways, conforming to your job role, conforming to your gender, so on and so forth, right?
Well,
these ideals.
It's what makes capitalism work, right?
Okay, you're tying that to capitalism.
Well, you know, we have a system that relies on people. We have a system, particularly if we want to stick with men.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's only about maybe 150 years that men get up in the morning and leave their families to go to work.
Yeah.
which is an unnatural thing to do. So,
So
how do you incentivize men to get up in the morning and leave their families and go to work? You have to create some kind of system where they don't just say, I don't want to do that.
And that's accelerated since the world wars too, right? Yeah. Like our modern work world is very much a product of post-World War II.
Right. And even in World War II, where women entered the workforce in great numbers and showed that women could be in the workforce, when the war was over, we sent them back home. So it didn't have anything to do with competence. It had to do with the comfort and security find in gender roles. Oh, I know what I'm supposed to do.
Okay, Avram, speaking of capitalism, we got to go to a break. Hold that thought. We'll be back with Avram Royce talking men in intimate relationships on It's Not Therapy. Questions, comments, concerns, nottherapyshow.com or at nottherapyshow on social media. Be back after the break. The following program is a peer-to-peer advice show and does not diagnose mental health conditions. If you're seeking social services, please call or text 211 or go to 211.ca. Back on It's Not Therapy. I'm still Leanna Kersner. I'm still not a therapist. We're still in the interview talking men's fear of women in intimate relationships. Yep, I got an expert on that. Don't take my word for it. He's the one with the book. Author of Hidden in Plain Sight, How Men's Fears of Women Shape Their Intimate Relationships, Avram Weiss, PhD. And before the break, Avram and I were talking about the social constructs of work outside the home. The incentives, although it's more stick than carrot, to get men unnaturally outside the home and away from their families to, you know, produce capital. And what that does to the family dynamic and relationships between heterosexual relationships, men and wife. And this is a serious social problem, not just in, you know, heterosexual middle-class couples. We see it in the opioid epidemic in places like Eastern Kentucky, where men lost their jobs in the coal mines.
Absolutely.
And so they thought, we're going to train women as nurses. That'll solve the economic problem. It didn't solve the psychological problem of the complete inversion of the heterosexual relationship, right?
Right. And the step that came before that was men's identity being almost entirely defined by their productivity. If you are what you do, then you're incredibly vulnerable to losing your sense of productivity. And so if you become unemployed or disabled, you're kind of SOL.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a real issue for many men I work with who are disabled and feel like they have to keep producing. Their blood pressure's through the roof. You know, they're having organ failure. It's like, slow down. You don't have to stop, but slow down. And there is this perception that the people in their lives, especially their female partner, would prefer them dead to useless.
Well, you're biting off a whole big piece there.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to go there with you, but it's...
Well, there's three pieces, right? There's three assumptions there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're bringing in the woman's half of the equation, and it's critically important. So I've started work on a new project, which is getting about as much interesting response as the one about men, fears of women, which is, you know, men talk all the time about feeling criticized by women. Incessantly. It's a preoccupation with men. You never get it right with her. She keeps moving the goalposts. No matter what I do, it's not enough. So I started wondering, so what am I missing here? What is this criticism that men are talking so much about? So I started wondering about where that comes from. So I started asking women in workshops, what did you learn? What did your mother teach you about men? And the answers have, so I've interviewed, you know, many women now, and if any of your listeners are interested, they can email me and I'm happy to interview them for the show. But it's not nice.
No.
I compare it to, in the African-American community, there's what's referred to as the talk.
Yeah.
Which is the talk that you have with your children as they go out in the world, in which you instruct them how to be careful and not get shot.
All the marital advice I was given from women of the previous generation were some form of manipulating a lazy man to do something he doesn't want to do, or give up resources he doesn't want to give. Things like hide money. emotionally manipulating him by saying things that you know are going to deeply hurt him.
Right.
The weirdest one was, don't barbecue. Always have him do the barbecuing because it's the only form of cooking he will do.
So you and I should definitely do an interview about this.
Yeah.
Schedule it on time.
Love to barbecue, so nobody takes my grill.
So think about, okay, so here's all that learning.
Yeah.
That's in you.
Yeah.
And then you end up in a relationship with a man, and that's in the room. It's like a ghost in the room. And he keeps sensing this criticism of him, whether you're saying it or not. And he's reacting to that, but you're not aware of the criticism because it's largely unconscious. So you're wondering what the hell he's being so reactive to. So you get defensive and it goes from there.
I've actually had conversations with my husband where he said, you're criticizing me. And I said, where?
Right.
And it's interesting that
you can't necessarily see it.
It wasn't even the words I used. It was a memory that the words triggered that I had zero awareness of.
Right.
And that's very real, but it's impossible to know that somebody's going to go there.
Right. But of course, remember, he was raised by a woman who held some of those same critical beliefs about men. So it's not new to, it's not his first rodeo either.
Yeah. And that's the thing. We all bring baggage into every relationship we have. And I do think that everybody is so sensitive to criticism because of the nonsense we're told about. You know, we tend to see the marriage as the end of the story in a relationship. We don't get many fairy tales between the time you get married and the mom dies, right? It all picks up after that with the wicked stepmother. And these are our cultural myths. These are our touchstones. These are the things we compare ourselves to. So what do we do? How do we start the process of better knowing this stuff is so ingrained and we all have the brain worms to some point?
Sure. Well, I think the answer is one that caught me by surprise and was a big learning for me, which is if you work as a therapist, you develop a prejudice that men are not very good at talking about their emotions.
Interesting.
Gossip constantly about men in not very nice ways, that they're difficult to work with, that they don't know how to talk, that it's like pulling teeth with them. And they start with a sort of often negative set of assumptions about men. But what I've learned, because I started doing therapy groups for men only, and what I learned is that none of those stereotypes apply if you don't start with that negative set of assumptions.
Yeah, I was going to say,
my therapy groups for men are as open and maybe even more so than the mixed groups that I've done for decades. And so we've done a tremendous disservice, I think, to men and really unfairly stereotyped them. And so back to your question, the answer, I think, for most men starts with talking with other men, because I think it goes better as a starting place. I think there's so much baggage that makes it so hard for men to talk to women. It's not that, obviously, we want that to happen eventually. But what I've learned through experience is I think the best starting place for most men is talking to another man or to a woman who is, as you clearly seem to be, who has some interest and understanding and respect for the interior lives of men. Which,
yeah, well, I mean, I was a video game journalist for a decade. So one of those things that I find that men communicate their feelings differently, and people miss it.
Yeah.
So, you know, a guy will be talking for 45 minutes and someone will say, well, you didn't talk about your feelings. And I'm sitting here thinking, well, yeah, it was there. It was just the code was different.
And also part of it is that people don't expect men to talk about their feelings. And so they don't ask them about their, you know, they're.
Yes.
You know, there's a book out there written by a woman therapist for other women therapists, which, you know, how to work with men. And it's incredibly insulting because she basically says men can't talk about their feelings. So you have to dumb it down for them. So if you start with those kind of expectations, then how do you think men are going, you know, how do you think it's going to go?
Yeah, you're setting an expectation, but you're also creating a self-fulfilling prophecy. You're waiting for that switch to get flipped. So the slightest little thing. Yeah.
So that's been their whole life. So they probably grew up in families in which they weren't expected to be emotionally fluent. Then they move into intimate relationships. And so at some point, if someone, it reminds me, I used to work in a prison and I had these amazing experiences where I would sit down with these guys. And I don't know if this is true or not, but I kept having the idea that this was the first time in this person's life that someone has sat and listened to them in a respectful way.
I hear that from a lot of the guys I work with, that the media they like is demonized. The areas of interest they like are demonized. You know, anything, video games, comic books, sci-fi stuff, even sports is seen as aggressive and all that stuff. And so they feel shut down before they even begin to speak. And it does take a bit of time. I do YouTube videos, so guys know what my opinions are before they come talk to me. So obviously the wheels are really greased there. But without that, I'm sure it would be hours before they felt comfortable taking that risk, because what I've been told is every time before they've taken that risk, they've been shut down and then they've been blamed for doing it wrong.
Right. And then we say men are withholding and they don't talk about it. And we attribute that entirely to men. And it's not all about men. It's an awful about the context.
Yeah. And no one is good at anything right out of the gate. Right. If somebody is raised with a limited emotional vocabulary, well, you can't expect them to be anything but that. You know, you got to have tools like emotions wheels or common metaphors that they're comfortable that this sensation they have matches something that can refer to and is commonly understood. How do you start with, because even among groups of men, there's this policing, right? What do you do about that?
I'm going to surprise you and say, I don't have to do much.
Okay.
When you put a group of men together in a room and you make it clear that this is a place where you can talk, they're so eager and so relieved. So, first of all, I'm running a group. It's not a first-time group. There's already a culture in that group.
Right.
So when people come into the group, it's very clear to them that this is a group where you can talk about yourself. But even from the beginning, the groups I do with men are the only... I've been doing groups for over 50 years. The groups I do with men are the only groups I have ever run where people look each other in the eye and talk openly about loving each other.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is not the stereotype.
No, and I've noticed that too. When I say things like, thank you for trusting me, that was hard, I'm humbled. You see a shift when you say, I'm really proud of you for taking that risk, even if they got rejected. You see the shift. It's sort of almost like they were expected to get hit.
Right.
And then
so
worked.
This is a lot of the work that I do with couples is that, we start with these negative ideas about who the man is and what he's going to be like. And then I look and see how the interactions are between the two people. And it's clear to me what supports those expectations. And if I can get the woman to suspend those expectations for a while and be a little more open and make a little more room. So, for example, my favorite exercise with couples, particularly if they have young children, is I always send the mom away for several days.
Okay.
And I tell her she's not allowed to prepare any meals in advance. She's not allowed to arrange any play dates, nothing. Just leave. Preferably don't take your cell phone with you. Or if you do, don't take any calls.
Don't. Right.
And it always goes the same way. And I think you can imagine how it goes. The guy is very nervous at first, but within a few hours, he figures out how to do things his way. And by the time the mom gets home, the dad and the kids are having a blast. And the most common outcome of this is that the dad is the one who ends up saying, can we do this again? Because he is having the most intimate connection, because it's the first unsupervised time with his children he's ever had.
Wow.
They love it. Mm-hmm. They fight it. When I suggest it, they're furious at me. But I'm like, just give it a chance. It's their favorite time of the year. And they can't wait for their wife. They're like looking online for things their wives could go and do because they have such a great time with their kids.
Now, I imagine that a caveat to this is when the wife comes home, she doesn't criticize how the dad was a dad.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. You have to accept that, you know, if the house is still standing and the kids are alive, everything was fine.
Yeah, I hear a lot from men that their wives ripped a new one off them for days because they gave their kid pancakes for breakfast once. And that's mom guilt, where she's afraid what society's going to think of her as a mother because she let her husband do that. And all that language is, it's Foucaultian, right? It's power and control.
Well, it's awful because let's just break that down for a moment. So in the story you just told, you have a woman who's exhausted because she feels like she has to control every single aspect of what goes on. So she's exhausted. She's furious and resentful because she feels like she doesn't have a partner and never gets any help.
That's right.
She's not interested and not capable. And you have a man who feels emasculated and incompetent, not adequate as a father, and terrified to move. So who's happy in that situation?
Nobody. Nobody.
And not even men. I don't even talk about the kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, who are essentially being raised with half a father.
Yeah, and they're in a really pressurized environment that everything's, you know, the air crackles and the kids don't know why. So they end up with an anxiety condition.
And when, you know, they do these weekends, everybody has a blast, mom included.
Yeah.
And, you know, mom's a little anxious at first, but after the first half day, usually she relaxes into when she doesn't get a phone call.
Yes.
Realizes that everything's okay. Then she comes home and maybe the house is a mess, but the kids are so clearly, and it changes the family profoundly. And there's no going back. You can't then pretend that there's only one competent parent in the house. And so then the first night she comes back and it's bedtime, you have an interesting conversation. Well, A, who's going to put the kids to bed?
Yep.
And B, how we, you know, because there's the way you've always done it, but then there's the way I did it while you were gone. And the kids might say, could daddy put me to sleep tonight? And now mom's got to deal with like, well, it was always me that put him to bed and I want help, but I kind of like being the one that they go to all the time. So I have to make some hard, you know, but that's good conversation.
Absolutely. And this was great conversation. Awesome segue into the end of the interview. Albert Moise, PhD, author of Hidden in Plain Sight, How Men's Fears of Women Shape Their Intimate Relationships. Avram, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed talking with you.
When we come back for our final segment, more on these concepts of criticism and control on this episode about men and intimacy, why a lot of men fear women. Fear not. There is hope. We'll be back after this. Question, comments, concerns, nottherapyshow.com. Leanna at nottherapyshow.com is my direct email, or at nottherapyshow on X, formerly known as Twitter, Instagram, and Threads. We'll be back on It's Not Therapy. The following program is a peer-to-peer advice show and does not diagnose mental health conditions. If you're seeking social services, please call or text 211 or go to 211.ca. We're back in It's Not Therapy. I'm still Leanna Kirzner. I'm still not a therapist. And we're still talking men, intimacy, and fears of women. And yeah, it's been a lot from the male point of view this show, but Avram Weiss rightly said that you can't completely separate the man's experience from the woman's experience, and both of them in a heterosexual couple are dealing with the fact that if the issue is his mother or her mother, the problem technically isn't in the room when it's just the two of you, and yet the problem is still very much in the room when it's just the two of you. The idea of mothers psychologically abusing their children is not something we're quite ready to address as a culture, but, well, I'm going to go there anyway. One thing I see a lot in women, men do, oh, I hate that we always have to go men do or women do in these things, but the sensitivity is there. But I see this a lot in women. They do things that are manipulative that they don't recognize are manipulative. It's just how to do to get what you want, even when the other person doesn't want to give it to you. And that's the definition of manipulation. Manipulation is about the control of information to some way restrict the other person's options. And a lot of women not only learn negative stereotypes of men from their mothers, they get criticized intensively by their mothers. And this is intended to mold them into proper ladies. Their moms are trying to help. But what it does more than anything is normalizes just quote unquote sucking it up when you hear hurtful, passive aggressive and hurtful things and not being able to say stop because you just have to accept she's doing her best. We don't like this stuff. Nobody likes this stuff. Similarly, men are often raised in environments where talking about how you feel means criticizing the other person, sometimes savagely. Many men have backgrounds where they were bullied into compliance or action by the adults in their lives. And again, they were taught, you don't like it, but it's normal. I talk about butchered I feel statements all the time. Stuff like, I feel like you were wrong, or I feel that you made a mistake. These statements start with I feel, but they're not actually talking about your feelings. I'm disappointed that you made that mistake, or I'm hurt by the fact that you're so wrong about my motivations. Those statements are leading with feelings. Now, much like top 10 phrase, other people don't have to like your boundaries, but they do have to accept them. Other people don't have to like your feelings. You don't have to like the feelings someone expressed. It can feel very unfair, but it is important to accept that that is legitimately how the person feels. Now, these are learned skills, and not everyone has been given the opportunity to learn these emotional skills. Men and women typically have different deficits in terms of learned connection to emotions or naming our feelings. Women are not innate masters of emotional communication. No, no. As a kid, I was a crier. I still kind of am, which is great in acting, but it's considered weakness in the rest of the world. And I've always felt this intense pressure to force myself to fake happy or feel angry instead of scared, hurt, or sad so I don't cry. But my whole life, that's felt really dishonest. And I don't like what I do when I get angry and lash out instead of feeling sad or hurt or scared and crying. And I've realized either way, I'm going to end up embarrassed. And while crying is more embarrassing, you know, intensely in the short term, it's less hurtful to other people and therefore overall less embarrassing and less hurtful in the long term. That temporary embarrassment is good happy math, even though none of it's happy. You have no idea how many people think that's doing it wrong. Similarly, I have a lot of clients apologize every time they raise their voice, even though they're not yelling at me, they're just yelling around me. I assure them that it's okay, that getting angry is healthy as long as, you know, it stays in bounds. I see clients over Zoom. They can't physically hurt me. So if they yell a bit, so what? Anger is a stage of grief. All this is linked to expectations and this ridiculous idea that people can always control ourselves. A lot of us grew up hearing that. Control your emotions, right? We can't control our emotions. They happen faster than our thoughts. Now, I prefer instead the language of regulating instead of controlling. I regulate myself because, well, I have a PTSD diagnosis. I know that if I get symptomatic, I am not myself. And the only thing I can control about that is avoiding getting to that point. Getting enough sleep, eating properly, exercising, managing stress, setting those time boundaries. I'm terrible at that. Managing energy, bad at that too. You know, regulating my baseline. So I have maximum distress tolerance when into each life some chaos falls. If you think you can control yourself because your parents told you you could, not only are you going to fail a lot, you're going to feel really tempted to try to control other people to get that feeling of control from somewhere. And one of the ways we control other people, because it's how we were controlled, is through criticism. Top 10 phrase, don't let problems that aren't your fault lead to mistakes that are. If you're feeling out of control, that's a problem. Don't let it lead to the mistake of lashing out and criticizing or abusing your partner. Instead of hinting, manipulating, or complaining, ask direct, specific questions and be prepared to hear the answers. That's where my top 10 phrase, ignoring negatives isn't being positive, comes in. Yeah, we're all deathly afraid of hearing certain things from our partners. But we have to be prepared to hear both yes and no for either response to really matter. Ironically, I think a lot of women are going to feel criticized by this show. I get that. You know, it's been very much from men and the male perspective. I feel a bit criticized by this show. And yeah, it's really frustrating that we're stuck dealing with the after effects of stuff our mother-in-laws did. It's not fair. It isn't fair. But do you want the relationship to work? Because, you know, your husband, your boyfriend, he can't help what his mom did to him. Now, it's totally fair to say, no, I'm not willing to deal with the momzilla wreckage. That means the marriage won't last. But that happens sometimes. And on the other side, it feels awful to be rejected for the damage that our parents did to us. Trust me, I grew up hearing, you're just like your father my entire young life. And that wasn't a compliment. But that's the sort of feminine cycle of behavior I decided I wanted to break. Remember that just because your man feels criticized doesn't mean you intended to criticize him, and it doesn't mean he has the right to criticize you or abuse you out of spite or revenge. And yes, a lot of you women listening, we've been on the receiving end of a lot of that. The negative experiences aren't all vicarious through our mothers. You don't have to accept abuse. You don't have to accept false accusations of intent. You can set that boundary and still care that he felt criticized. And guys, please use the I feel statements, real I feel statements. I felt criticized, instead of you're criticizing me. Certainly don't say you're always criticizing me. Trust me, I feel criticized will go over a lot better. One of the things I really believe is that everyone benefits when men and women talk honestly and compassionately with each other. Everybody talking to everyone. Better. Yes. Good. It costs you nothing to tell the other person what they mean to you. Positive things, especially when you're feeling vulnerable or even angry with them. That costs you nothing. It could cost you everything if you deny someone validation and reassurance in one of those moments. Because being angry at someone doesn't mean you stop caring about them. But if your partner comes from an abusive home, they probably could use some active reassurance that your love is not conditional, because the love of one or both parents was. All right, that's our show for this week. Next week I'm off because it's Passover. I'll be back the week after that. Until then, your crazy is only a problem if it's hurting you or someone else. Take care.